You are on the record.
Okay, thank you. All right. I'll advise the public that the board did not take any action on matters discussed while in executive session. The session was limited to discussion of matters directly protected by the public disclosure by the Open Meeting Act. So we are out of executive session. So that brings us to item number B under new business, resolution G24-12-HEX.
Yes, Chair. I was just informed that Mr. Richards with AGDC has a time conflict and is requesting to be allowed to speak now so that he can make a next appointment. His presentation. He's not set until later after the resolutions. He's asking if he can get that presentation in before the resolutions.
Well, this shouldn't take very long here.
Yeah, no, we can go pretty quickly if you want. Yeah. So I'll start with 6B, item 6B, Chair, resolution G24-11 related to ANWR. This resolution mirrors previous resolutions before the board that have been approved that allow and authorize the executive team at ADA to review, to perform due diligence, and eventually bid if
No. This is HEX. G24-12-HEX.
Oh, you're on HEX.
He was on 11.
Item number B is G24-12-X.
That's what I'm working on.
Mine's C.
I have no idea. I'm just reading off the agenda.
Yeah, I've got a different one.
There is an update that we're not made aware of.
Oh. Well, we're going to do HEX. Let's do HEX.
So let's do HEX. Chair, that's G24-12. Resolution related to HEX would authorize the executive team at ADA to pursue loan terms in a maximum amount up to $50 million with HEX, with each segregable distinct phase of drilling considered a separate request that ADA with staff and executive team would perform due diligence on before approving any additional draws on the line of credit. And so the interest rate is set at 10%. The term is up to 5 years, and we think we can manage things discreetly as each work item comes forward. So the current work item that's before HEX is two sidetrack wells. Roughly estimated to cost, I think, $12 million each. One is nearly complete, and the decision whether to go forward with the second one is up to Mr. Hendricks.
All right. Where are we at on origination fees, annual fees? What's the terms?
Right.
Of the loan.
So the terms that we had, right? The terms that we had staff recommending chair was a 1% origination fee and 50 basis points per year after that.
What per year?
50 basis points.
Okay. Yeah. On the $50 million?
Correct.
And I assume there are cash flow requirements and whatnot that, loan.
Correct.
That the HEX has to do?
Everything monitored closely, reporting, regular reporting, and these breaks in segments of phases of the project.
Is there a term on how long the after this resolution, how long the line of credit is available before it's, to put in the origination fee and to actually have the commitment? How long?
Well, the term, I think the loan is active for 5 years.
No, but how long before the borrower has to, in order to execute? In other words, sign the loan documents, may not take any money, but sign the loan documents, pay the fees.
It's due on that closing of signing.
But how long does he have to close?
I'd have to take a look at that.
It's not term. Open-ended. You can't wait 6 months.
Right. No, I thought it was 30 days.
Or 12 years. Yeah. Or.
Right. No, I think we had it at 30 days, Chair.
How long?
30.
So 30 days from the resolution?
Yeah. And Jeff can join us. He's quite familiar with it as well. Is that right, Jeff, 30 days?
For the record, yeah, this is Jeff Johns, and that's correct.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add for the record? I'm trying to get it all on the record, Jeff.
No, I'd just like to emphasize, as the board has heard previously, is Hex Cook Inlet was a previous borrower from Ada approximately 4 years ago, acquiring the assets out of foreclosure. It was a $7.5 million loan, and that loan was paid off approximately 8 months early. And so Hex has proven to be a creditworthy and very good borrower and partner for Ada previously.
Before I ask Mr. Hendricks to come up, any questions for Randy or Jeff?
So we're doing 12 and then 11.
Come on up, John. Briefly, kind of let us know what you're doing and what the money is going to be used for.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you. Hex Cook.
I need your name and title and everything for the record.
Okay. John Lee Hendricks. President CEO of Fury Exploration and Hex Cook Inlet, Hex. We acquired this company in June of 2020 and proudly are working with a number of Alaskans to fix something that failed in the past that was outside and foreign ownership. And thanks to the original Ada loan, we were able to prove that Alaskans can run an oil and gas company in our own state. And we've been very successful at it. We've been doing geological reviews since we took over and have identified 10 near bore targets that we can drill and possibly up to 27. We feel very comfortable that we can deliver gas for Alaskans. And as an Alaskan from Homer, Alaska, I want to do this. We took the, good faith, run that when the rig became available from Hillcorp that we picked up the jackup rig to move it on one of our well slots, and now we're currently drilling, and we're basically 1,000 foot from total depth. Hopefully that well will be completed in the next week, and if we get DNR royalty equalization for our field equivalent to other fields, we'll probably move on to a second well. With your money that you're giving us and funding us, we can basically target wells that can deliver soon and in the next couple of years. And we hope to churn it as quick as we can. Drill a well, pay you off, use the money again, and drill again. But I'm an Alaskan. I'm here to basically try to help the need to bring Alaskan gas to Alaskan homes. So, thank you.
So, based on your current volume that you're producing now for Cook Inlet, what do you anticipate the addition to, in other words, percentage of volume that you hope to increase your current daily production?
Yeah, we're currently at 5%. This should get us up to 10%, and maybe beyond that to 15. Our development plan is, of course, more than $50 million. But it's in the stage approach. We have gas near us that we can harvest, and we'd like to continue to harvest what's near and bring it on as soon as possible. Rig availability, Cook Inlet supply and infrastructure is a big thing that gets in the way. And right now our biggest challenge to drill a second well outside of we have an application in DNR for royalty equalization is weather. And we'd like to basically get that equalized and move forward and drill a second well.
So the bottom line is the goal, if everything works according to your projections, with the $50 million revolving line of credit, you hope to double your capacity supply to South Central Alaska.
Yes. We have over 50 million. We could produce 50 million a day through our infrastructure, no problem.
Just so the public knows what.
Yes, we could double.
Public interest of why it is loaning in order to help facilitate additional gas for the consumer in South Central.
Correct. We believe if we continue moving this direction, we believe the Fury, the kitchen lights unit reserves could delay any Cook Inlet shortage to the year 2039 if we do it properly. But right now, we just have to fix a few little issues.
Right. Any questions for Mr. Hendrick?
John, is that just from the platform?
Yes, that's from the platform. We feel there's about 300 bees within a 3-mile radius of our platform that we can drill. Currently, we produce only 3 bees a year. And the demand for Anchorage gas is 70 bees a year total.
Further questions? Well, thank you, John. We wish you all the best on success on doubling your production and helping the residents of South Central.
Well, thank your support for our Alaskan team, and we aim to continue being successful. Thank you very much.
Any further discussion from the executive team?
No, Chair.
With that, I'll take a motion for resolution G24-11.
This is Bill Kendig. I move.
Oh, wait. Sorry, wrong number. G24-12.
Yep. This is Bill Kendig. I move resolution number G24-12, resolution of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority approving a development project financing revolving line of credit under Alaska Statute 44.88.172 to Hex Cook Inlet LLC to increase Cook Inlet natural gas production and supply.
Second, Randy Ailey.
Thank you, Randy. All right, discussion. Remy, would you pull the board?
Commissioner Sandy?
She's not there.
Commissioner Crum?
Yes.
Mr. Kendig?
Yes.
Mr. Fogel is absent. Mr. Ellidge?
Yes.
Mr. Vivlamore?
Yes.
Chair Pruse?
Yes.
The motion passes.
All right. I'd like to go to resolution G24-11 ANWR. And for time, the fact that we may lose a board member or two, Randy, would you let's go ahead and get it on the table?
Sure.
No, wait.
I move resolution number G24-11, resolution with Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority relating to the evaluation and potential submission of bids for the Coastal Plain Alaska Oil and Gas Sale Lease.
Randy Ellidge, second.
Thank you. All right, now for discussion.
Randy? Thank you, Chair. So this resolution before the members and the Chair would authorize the executive staff to perform due diligence, review, and possibly bid and submit bids for the next ANWR lease sale. It mirrors previous resolutions approved by the board and authorizes executive staff to encumber no more than $20 million, which is the similar number from previous resolutions, to pay for project-related expenses. And we anticipate that sale, Chair, to be it's due by federal law December of 2024.
Is it going to be before our December board meeting? Do we have a December board meeting?
It would be after. It would be after the 11th, Chair.
The sale would be after the 11th?
Right.
All right. So I would ask that obviously you give us an update on your due diligence and your things that on the public, so the public knows on December 11th what your recommendations for final investment.
We will do that, Chair.
So this authorizes you to do the due diligence, investigating, and whatnot. It does have a dollar amount, but from my perspective, I would expect before you actually pull any triggers that we talk about it again in December.
Yes, correct.
Okay. All right. Discussion? Randy?
Randy, is there any possibility of this being pulled back like what this administration has done to us before?
Right. So, Member Ellidge, what we've heard through the grapevine or other sources is that the agency intends to hold the sale that they're acknowledging the deadline established in federal statute as a hard deadline. What we're more concerned about at the staff level, are there any conditions or overlays of zoning types of land use that could be put in? The Gwich'in tribe or community has requested a layer of zoning placed over all of, virtually all of Anwar as a caribou habitat zone or a culturally significant zone for the Gwich'in. That's drawn a lot of concerns, and frankly, it's probably contrary to the federal statutes that say there will be an oil and gas program in Anwar in the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act. But we would not be surprised, given the actions of BLM and the Department of Interior to date, if there were some conditions placed into the sale that would make it virtually impossible to develop in Anwar. Wouldn't surprise us. We're hoping they don't do that, you know, but, you know, we had valid leases that they arbitrarily canceled, so we're not really putting a lot past them. But we think there will be a sale. The conditions of the sale we'll have to keep a real close eye on.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Remy, would you pull the board?
Commissioner Sandy? Commissioner Crum?
Yes.
Mr. Kendig?
Yes.
Mr. Elledge?
Yes.
Mr. Vivlamore?
Yes.
Chair Prus?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you. So that brings us back to resolution G24-1T, aid of retention of outside counsel, Ambler Road.
Okay. I move resolution number G24-13, resolution of Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority approving the retention of outside counsel and initiation of litigation to address unlawful federal overreach severely impacting its projects and mission.
Randy Elledge, second.
Thank you both. Discussion, Randy.
Sure. Chair, this resolution, G24-13, outlines several actions taken by the federal government related to the Ambler Road project and leases in Anwar that describe how those actions are illegal, inconsistent with federal law. And the resolution then authorizes the executive team to litigate and push back on these actions if necessary through litigation, and establishes it as a policy of the board, which means it will be have to come back to the board to change that policy. So this places the position of the authority on record as opposing these actions by the federal government, having authority to litigate them, and making it so any changes would have to come back to the board.
What are we going to spend?
That's a good question, Chair. Expense amounts are difficult, you know, to estimate. It'll certainly be heavily fought if it's a continuation of the current administration. They oppose development in Anwar. They've made that very clear. They oppose development of the Ambler Road. They've made that very clear. So that sets up a very probably protracted litigation scenario. In contrast, if President Trump was to win, he's very supportive of development in Anwar and likely supportive of mining and the Ambler Access Road. So it's there's probably a wide range of outcomes there, Chair.
So is this circumventing Department of Law and the state taking the lead?
We will be speaking with the Department of Law and have been on working with them to work together in the litigation. Currently, ADA has separate statutory authority, of course, to litigate these cases. So we don't necessarily have to only go forward with law, but we would like to go forward with law. And they have an opportunity to lead if they'd like to. We brief them regularly. But this doesn't require ADA to be in the lead. It only allows us to go forward if necessary. So law can always come to us and say, hey, we'd like to take lead on that, and more than likely that'd be fine.
Okay, maybe I'm confused there. So there's no budgetary number, so we don't know that. We don't know how long it's going to take, and we don't know who's taking the lead, but yet you want this resolution?
Well, the resolution is just, I think the intent of the resolution is to put it not in stone, right, but harden the position of the authority that we will be pushing back on these efforts of the federal government. Whether ADA's in the lead or not, or Department of Law is, either way, we'll be participating. To change that, so if there was a new board or a new executive director, the decision to not participate in these cases would have to come back to the full board.
All right, so you're not hiring an attorney yet, and you're not going to spend any money yet until you have a decision on who's taking the lead and what the ultimate decision is by either a new administration or the other administration?
I think we'll be watching the election outcomes, and we will be talking to the Department of Law.
I'm just wondering if we got the cart before the horse here.
You know, the principle that the resolution would establish is simply that ADA will participate in an effort to push back on these federal actions by the Biden administration that have delayed or held up our projects. It doesn't require it, but it does make it so that it's a board decision at board discretion to ever take a different position. So if we were going to drop out of the cases or not defend these projects, that would take a vote of majority of the board.
But we're not going to spend any money.
We're in some active litigation now, Chair, over the projects, right?
What active?
So what's active is our lease cancellation case.
We actually executed a suit?
That litigation's been ongoing for quite a while.
So we've actually sued the federal government on it?
Correct.
And who's taking the lead on that?
We've taken the lead on it.
No. Which is it, internal legal counsel or external?
It's both. It's internal and external counsel with Birch Horton.
And do we have a budget for that?
We do have a budget set out. I believe it's $500,000.
All right. So this would fall under that $500,000?
Correct.
What I'm getting is I'm very uncomfortable with, I understand, you know, we're not going to take it lying down, and we're going to oppose it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very uncomfortable with an open-ended checkbook with legal fees and without the board coming back and understanding and approving what the ultimate plan is.
Understood, Chair. And if you'd like to, we could set this aside and bring back some hard numbers with estimates as best as we can at the next meeting.
Well, and I don't mind that, but I would like you to resolve the issue with Department of Law, who's taking the lead, because that'll play into the dollars.
Sure.
That plays into the dollars, and then ultimately there'll be an election.
Right. And we can, I think we can reach resolution with law by the next meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
So would the board entertain a pause until the next board meeting on this resolution?
This is Bill Kendig. I move to table resolution G2413 till our next board meeting, and I'm not sure what that date is. November 7th. Randy?
I second Randy Elledge.
Is there anybody opposed to tabling it till our next board meeting? Hearing that? All right. Just table to the next board meeting. I just like a little more information, sure. Randy.
No problem.
Board members do too.
Yeah, no problem, Chair.
Okay. We're not going to take up G2414 at this time. That'll be postponed before you got more due diligence to do based on conversations. So it brings us up to item number 7, Director's Comments.
I think we've got 6F Chair AGDC presentation.
Okay, but it's not on my list here, so. Huh? Well, I don't have time to read my email, so I'm running a board meeting. So maybe a new one of these next time, so I can just replace it. Yeah. All right, I guess bring them in.
Sure.
Not a big deal. If I was to read all my emails right now, I'd have 50 that I have to start reading right now, Remy. Thank you.
I want to make sure the votes.
Yep, we're all done voting.
Okay. I'll see you later.
I gave you 10 minutes to spare, man.
Safe travels. You did, thank you.
Yeah.
Safe travels. Okay. Thank you, Les. Thank you, Bill. It can't be sketchy. Walk into the car.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Mr. Frank.
Mr. Chairman.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Fancy seeing you again.
Commissioner's leaving?
Yeah.
Okay. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Yeah, he saw who was coming in and said, I'm out of here.
He heard me yesterday.
So, Frank, welcome. For the record, we'll need you to introduce yourself, what you're doing, and, for the public record. So,
very good, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Frank Richards. I'm the president of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. That's a state corporation that was created by the Alaska legislature in 2013. Specifically to look to commercialize the North Slope natural gas assets for Alaskans, essentially energy for Alaska. So today I wanted to be able to provide you with an update on how we're advancing the project, which we call the Alaska LNG project, and then specifically talk about a subset, which is the Alaska gas pipeline. Next slide, please. So the gas pipeline is essentially been a long-standing dream of Alaska since Prudhoe Bay was developed and put under when TAPS went under operation. The next major project was going to be the gas line. So we are advancing the prospect of bringing natural gas forward to Alaskans. This project stands fully designed, meaning that we have designed a project to be able to deliver gas from the North Slope down to South Central Alaska to an export facility, and it has received all the federal permits. So we've run the gauntlet of the federal permitting process, and that took a significant amount of time, but those permits are in hand and in place. And actually what we see is that we received those under the Trump administration, and I'm happy to report that the Biden administration is also defending those authorizations as recently as this week when a court action in the U.S. District Court of Appeals was brought to bear by the Sierra Club and Center for Biological Diversity, and the Department of Justice thoroughly defended that authorization. So we are working with North America's premier pipeline company to be able to develop this project. They stand shoulder to shoulder with us, working to look at the design and the cost estimates, and ultimately to be able to provide this with gas providing lower cost energy for Alaskans. So that's the opportunity. So next slide, please. So when I talk about the Alaska LNG project, this is the large project that looks to monetize the North Slope assets from Prudhoe Bay, from Point Thompson and satellite fields around there. We know that there's in excess of 100 trillion cubic feet of natural gas on the North Slope. So significant amount of gas. The project that I talked about being permitted is that full project. It includes a conditioning plant on the North Slope for gas coming out of Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, an 807-mile pipeline, and then a liquefaction facility where we would export liquefied natural gas to the Asian markets. But the Alaska gas pipeline is a subset of that, and that's why we're calling this phase one of the Alaska LNG project, which is to develop that pipeline to deliver gas to Alaskans. So this would be the initial phase of a two-phase effort, the second phase being LNG exports. Next slide, please. So the economic benefits of this are that This will build a piece of infrastructure that will deliver those resources initially for Alaskans' use and then ultimately for economic benefit through export or use within the state of Alaska for new industries. So the project is a 42-inch diameter pipeline, so significantly overbuilt for Alaska's needs. However, when we look at the economics of the project, we see that building this project with the permits that we have in hand is the fastest way to be able to deliver gas for Alaskans.
So Frank, is the 42-inch tied to the permit, or is Correct. It any size? Can you go lower or bigger? Or?
Mr. Chairman, the project was designed with a 42-inch diameter pipeline.
So it has to be 42-inch?
Correct. Otherwise, if you wanted to go smaller or larger, you'd have to open up the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy process, and that has risk associated with it.
So is there an option on the pressurization, how much pressure you put, how much gas you move?
So the project was designed to flow 3.3 billion cubic feet a day at 1,480 PSI. And that's with 8 compressor stations. So if you have smaller volumes, then you don't need the compression, and you still have your pressure rating.
Okay, so you can slow it down.
You can't
change the diameter, but you can slow down the volume.
Correct.
How slow can you go?
Well, for 200 million standard cubic feet a day, which is probably the average annual consumption that Alaska needs, we would pressure it to around 1,400, and it could flow without additional compression all the way south to south central.
Okay.
So the goals that this would do would, again, gas for Alaskans, but it would also provide access for future industrial customers. That could be the LNG plant that we've already designed. It could be relating to the expansion of data centers for artificial information or for blue ammonia. So those anchor customers are large industrial customers that would take up a significant amount of gas, which would help lower the cost for Alaskans. Ancillary benefits are the jobs from constructing the project, but also operating it. And then when there's a gas pipeline infrastructure in place, that opens up the opportunity for explorers on the North Slope to look for more gas, which is something that has been a challenge, is for folks to look for oil, they find gas, and there's no way to get it to market. And then ultimately, it's to lower the cost to Alaskans. So as you put more volume through this pipeline, the volume discount comes to Alaskans and Alaskan consumers. Next slide, please. So the timeline that we're looking at to move forward with this phase one of the project is to start what is known as front-end engineering design as early as the end of this year. Get that going forward to be able to bring us up to 2024-25 cost estimates and be able to then start working on offtake agreements, which would help underpin the financing of this project, and then ultimately enter into the construction period in 26-27 timeframe with the delivery of first gas for Alaska in 2023. Our economics, we've just had a third-party verification or validation done by a group called Wood Mackenzie on the economics of the project, and that will be presented ultimately in the public to the legislature next month. We are out raising equity capital right now to provide for a feed backstop with the pipeline operator, and I'll go into that in a moment. But that pipeline operator would then move forward with FEED to be able to design the Alaska LNG pipeline project and then get it to a point of execution for a final investment decision. So next.
Your FEED supply to the Alaska version of the 42-inch line is who?
So to go out to FEED, we're going to use a North American pipeline company.
Who's providing the product going in the pipeline? Who are you buying the gas from?
I'll get to that in a second, Mr. Chairman. Again, we've got multiple sources, but we've already have gas sale precedent agreements, and I'll identify that.
And you mentioned, does that have to be conditioned?
So depending on the source.
Okay.
So across the North Slope, and I'll just get into it right now, Prudhoe Bay has fairly high CO2. So in order to take this gas down to pipeline quality spec for consumers and utilities, you need to be able to drop that high percentage CO2 down to around 3%. The Alaska LNG project is designing the treatment to take it from that high level CO2 down to LNG quality spec. So that's 50 parts per million. And the rationale for that has always been capture the CO2 on the North Slope where you can sequester it and not have to then push a byproduct like CO2 down the pipeline when you have valuable space for the methane molecules that you can then turn into LNG. Prudhoe Bay has high CO2. Point Thompson has less CO2. And then there's new finds on the North Slope where there's actually little to no CO2. Not the quality that we've had in Cook Inlet where you've got literally zero CO2, but 0.5% CO2. So coming out of the development, you can have gas flowing directly from that new production right into the pipeline for Alaskans' use.
Okay, and how many years of product do you have like that with very little CO2?
So with very little CO2, the prospect now has about 15 to 20 trillion cubic feet of gas, and we so that's in excess of if we stayed at 200 million a year, let's say 20, it'd be 100 years of supply.
So 200 million, does that include Fairbanks?
Yes.
Everybody hooked up in Fairbanks. Yep. And that's in the 200 million, but you have to put more down through the pipeline, more than 200, or you can dial it down to 200.
Dial it down to 200.
Okay. Right.
So the goal, again, with that new development, we've got a gas sale precedent agreement at a price less than a dollar per million BTU. Because gas is a byproduct, they're searching for oil, they have gas, they don't want to have to do gas handling, they'll hand it off to us for between a zero and a dollar.
Okay.
All right, quickly on to feed. Understanding feed, this is, again, the development of a project takes multiple milestones and stage gates. So feed is an industry standard where you've done engineering to be able to bring it up to construction contract level and having a cost estimate that you can take to the bank essentially for financing. So it's that level of effort that we need to undertake for this pipeline. Really, it's updating the work that was done previously on the project led by ExxonMobil, where we had pre-feed and feed level of work done in 2015. So we have to bring it up to date to get the current cost estimates. So it's industry standard, it's what's bankable, and that's why we're out looking for financing for $50 million. And when I say we're out looking, we're in discussions with investors on coming into the project and providing the funds to execute feed. Our challenge has been, and what I'm talking about now, a feed backstop agreement, is that we haven't been able to reach that point of having investors provide the dollars necessary to start the feed. So when we went to the legislature and talked to them early this spring about a backstop where it would be essentially a line of credit that would be provided to the North American pipeline company to execute the feed, they said we wanted to make sure that there's validation of the economics of the project and the economic benefits to the state of Alaska. So that's what we did and had that third party validate it, and that's what the report that's coming out next month that shows, yes, a pipeline, in-state pipeline, at the volumes and at the diameter that I just talked about can meet or beat the price of imported LNG. And the economic benefits to the state of Alaska are significantly higher in terms of the gross value added represents anywhere from $10 to $17 billion to the state of Alaska over the life of the project. So we are actively negotiating now about a feed backstop agreement that would provide then a contract for the pipeline developer to start the feed and be able to develop it to industry standard to a point where we could then take it to a final investment decision and ultimately to construction. So in regards to the quickly on the third party economic assessment, this is where, next slide please. The legislature gave us that direction in this year's budget that said go forward, do an independent validation of the economics and the benefits to the state of Alaska from commercializing North Slope gas. And then if it's, if it proves positive, then essentially come back to the state of Alaska and we can all work together towards front-end engineering design of phase one of the Alaska LNG project. So that's the report that we're going to be giving to the legislature next month. So giving you somewhat of a preview of it right now, as I did to my board a couple weeks ago. So the firm that did this work was Wood Mackenzie. So they're an international natural resource consultancy firm that initially looked at this project when it was being led by Exxon, Conoco, and BP back in 2016. And then ultimately we hired them again in 2021 to revalidate the work that had been done. And so they are familiar with it. But what's most important is they did their own economic modeling, their own analysis, and brought in the information to meet their standards, not ours. So that report is what we were presenting and identifying that is it is a value to the state of Alaska to monetize the gas resources and ultimately provide lower cost energy to Alaska. So this chart here, they Wood Mackenzie developed. The stack on the left shows what, from their estimation, the cost of imported LNG would be to delivered to Alaska. So that's not to the end consumer, that's delivered to Alaska. And their range estimates from $10.21 up to $13.72, based on where the gas is sourced, the shipping distance to be able to get here. But what it didn't include was the cost of a marine dock investment necessary to get that gas offloaded from the ships on and into the distribution system. So that could possibly add an additional $500 million that isn't accounted for in these costs. The cost stacks on the right-hand side of this chart, the base load was essentially what AGDC had originally suggested that the price would be leading into the distribution system at $12.80. But Wood Mackenzie's analysis looked at the overall utilization of gas by homeowners, in utilities, and industry, and then did a 40-year lookout where they envisioned that there would likely be some small industrial demand growing, but there would also be some demand reduction by the utilities switching to renewables. And from their perspective, then, on a 40-year effort, it was $11.20, so still competing against imported LNG. And then if you add an industrial baseload to that, such as restarting of the Agrium plant or restarting a Kenai LNG or a new data center at a gigawatt level range, you would reduce the cost of Alaskans down to that nearly $9 per million BTU. And then the ultimate goal with the full execution and build out of Alaska LNG drops the price to Alaskans down to $2.23. So a significant reduction to what we're receiving today. So the next slide shows again the economic benefits to the state of Alaska from the phase one project. The stack on the left is what they call the Alaska gross value added. And this is the benefits that the state would gain over 40 years from the development of the project. So capital construction, taxes going into the state of Alaska coffers, new industry. The second stack, the potential savings, represents what consumers and utilities across the state would save by having a lower cost of gas from specifically the phase one project. And that added nearly $5.5 billion overall to the gross value added. And then the indirect and induced savings on top of that takes it up almost to $6 billion. So overall, about $16.5 billion of economic benefits to the state from developing just the initial phase of this project. So what we've been asked to present in the past is, well, how does this price stack up against what South Central Alaska is currently paying and what Fairbanks is currently paying specifically around fuel oil? And the cost is, equivalency is dollars per million BTU. So Fairbanks at the high end, this was done earlier this summer, so it's about, and it represents about $27.89 per million BTU. Fairbanks trucked LNG now has a cost of about $19.60. And then you've got imported LNG in that range that I talked about earlier from 1020 up to 1372. And then Cook Inlet gas, which is currently being supplied into the distribution system at 869. So that's the low end. And then on the right-hand side is really where we identify what could happen with lower cost energy from a pipeline. With the base load, with the Wood Mackenzie base case, the industrial anchor tenant, and then with Alaska LNG. So you can see the goal is ultimately to drive the cost down to Alaskans that are able to access this gas. For the Alaskans that are not tied directly into a pipeline, the legislature did create, when the project is up and running, that there will be a revenue stream that will be put in place for communities that don't have direct access to the pipeline to help in reducing the energy costs within those communities. So that's an ancillary benefit. Now, the anchor customer strategy that Wood Mackenzie looked at is initially they looked at just what it would take for Alaskans to make this project, to meet the needs to advance the project. And then they identified that there are going to be additional opportunities for anchor customers, and those are those industrial customers that I talked about, including LNG exports, including the ammonia production, including data centers. So those additional offtakes have the opportunity to help drive down the cost to Alaskans. So this is where we are different from the lower 48, where energy production lower 48 is set. You've got low-cost natural gas feeding into that energy production. There's been a reduction in greenhouse gases as new natural gas power generation is fired up. However, as you see new demand growing, such as from data centers, likely that's going to raise the cost of energy in the parts of the lower 48. Whereas the opposite is true with Alaska. If we have these anchor tenants, new industrial customers coming in, we will see the cost to Alaskans going lower. So that's the overall benefit. It's the lowest cost gas for Alaskans.
Pardon now, me.
Yes, sir.
Could thank you for backing up. Could you speak to us about the low carbon blue ammonia for export and getting it to market?
So Alaska currently has an ammonia facility that's been mothballed since 2008 due to lack of supply. That's the Agrium facility in Nikiski. Agrium, as an ammonia producer, is looking to produce what they would like to do is low-carbon ammonia. So as they look at plants or refurbishing their plants, they want to be able to put in place the reformers, but also carbon capture units that they would not be emitting the carbon dioxide into the air so that they could call it blue ammonia. We meet the standards of blue ammonia. So that's one option. So restart of an existing facility with carbon capture units being applied to it. Secondarily, we are in a memorandum of understanding with Japanese companies, Hillcorp and others within the state looking at new ammonia production in Nikiski from North Slope gas. So the option there is use the North Slope gas, capture the carbon from the stacks, and then be able to sequester it in Cook Inlet. In the areas around Cook Inlet where we've got 50 gigatons of carbon sequestration potential.
So this is at the Cook Inlet after the gas has come down from the North Slope. Can you speak to the sequestered CO2 on the slope? Is it going to be used for pressure maintenance or?
So the concept with the full Alaska LNG project is we'll be capturing about 7 million tons of CO2 a year. So taking that gas down to 50 parts per million. The challenge is, we're not going to be putting that CO2 back into the main reservoir because then you'd essentially just be recycling those CO2 molecules and your carbon dioxide percentage would be going up. So we're looking at opportunities that would sequester it in a separate but distinct portion of the geologic formations. What the oil industry has done is using CO2 to a certain extent for enhanced oil recovery, but they're also using water flood to be able to help for pressurization. So from their perspective, this will be the opportunity to use some of the gas, not all the gas. Remember, they're recycling about 8.5 billion standard cubic feet a day out of Prudhoe Bay alone. We'd be taking about 2.7 billion cubic feet from Prudhoe Bay. So that leaves over 5 that's still going to be need to be recycled and for gas cap pressurization within the unit. By reducing that gas flow through the gas handling systems, it actually will allow for more oil production because they've been limited on gas handling because as they've pumped more oil, there's been more gas coming up and they're limited in terms of gas handling.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So on to gas supply. So we, earlier this year, were engaged with a company called Great Bear Pantheon, which is a new developer on a unit just about 20 miles south of Prudhoe Bay. And there they have an unconventional gas, oil and gas find. And they've been delineating that with two specific areas, one which is what they call the Poon prospect, and the other is Kodiak, which is farther to the west. But the beauty of this particular prospect is it's directly adjacent to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, to the Dalton Highway, and to the Alaska LNG gas line centerline. So very close proximity, very easy to access. And as I said earlier, they are gas rich in this prospect, and they would like to be able to not have to handle it. So they entered into what is known as a gas sale precedent agreement, providing the gas at a maximum price to us for 500 million standard cubic feet a day. So 2.5 times what we would normally consume in the state of Alaska for a price less than a dollar. Low cost to access it. No, very little CO2 at about 0.5% CO2. So very clean gas. Now, again, they're not in development though. But we have a gas sales precedent agreement with them. In order to be able to go forward with the project, we need to make sure that we have additional supply should Great Bear Pantheon's prospect not be ready for delivery. And that's where we've been in conversations, negotiations with the producers that own the rights to gas in Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson and the satellite fields. So we've got agreements in place and negotiation with them to be able to supply the initial needs for Alaska at 200 million. And then ultimately to grow to the 3.3 billion cubic feet a day that we'll need for the Alaska LNG project.
So Frank, is the concept, I'm sure it has, I mean, I'm trying to keep up with all this. So if a pipeline is in place and a big driver of the cost is conditioning the gas up on the North Slope, so has it been discussed that someone puts the pipeline in, the oil company is responsible for conditioning their own gas to meet the levels that are required in order to be exported, and that's on them?
That is a negotiation point, Mr. Chairman.
I mean, obviously, the price would be amortized in the cost of the gas, but they themselves are responsible getting together, putting their own conditioning system in that goes into what I would call a multi-use pipeline.
I would say that again, from the producer's perspective, right now they're talking about trying to have sales at the wellhead. What has changed or what's in place now that makes the gas treatment plant an interesting prospect is with what's known as under the IRS tax code, the 45Q tax credits for a carbon capture plant can equate to essentially at the volumes that I'm talking about at 7 million tons per year could equate to almost $600 million a year of tax credits to the owner of that plant. So it's changed the dynamic, the economics of that plant from just being capturing a waste product, I'll call it CO2, and then having to pay to sequester it to now being a revenue generation in addition to the
CO2. So that actually facilitates oil companies conditioning their own gas.
They could, or a third party could.
Well, a third party wouldn't have the need. You know, I guess they could sell the tax credits, I suppose, But if, you know, a major, if a major needed it because they produce, you know, gas or oil every place else, if they could use that to offset it, it would incentivize them to do it.
They could.
And then they could be the, they could sell it to third parties or do whatever, because that's their business, the oil and gas. And I'm just thinking out loud here about, you know, we got a tube for you to put your gas in, mm-hmm. but you're responsible to put it in appropriately with the right conditions.
Right. Building that infrastructure first, like building a highway, the traffic's gonna flow. And whoever sees the best business model to be able to put those molecules into it is going to be the one that's going to be delivering the gas.
Yeah. Okay. How much more do you got?
This is it. Really just, and again, I identified this was the feedback coming out of the court that, again, the Biden administration had been challenging to the state of Alaska, but in this case, they're supporting an authorization for natural gas.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's what I wanted to provide.
Questions for Frank? How long will it take to do the verification, Frank?
Of the third party validation is done. So
the what the $50 million is for?
We're looking at fee being 12 to 14 months.
Okay. And is that 50 a hard number?
It's up to 50.
How do you control that? I'm just curious.
So through the feed backstop agreement, again, with AGDC being essentially the developer, then we have to agree to the scope. We would second people into that owner's team with the pipeline company to make sure we're managing within the budget, and then being able to make sure that the owner's costs are within line with industry standard.
How fast can you get that done?
The feed backstop agreement?
No.
Oh.
The scope and the pricing.
They've already gone out for preliminary pricing with six engineering procurement construction contractors. So they've already got a flavor of what the market will be to be able to do that. So that's why we capped it at 50. So that includes the price of the EPC, owner's costs, and contingency on top of that.
So when I think of capping at 50, that means they're authorized to spend 50. So I'm just curious, so if you get the numbers, the actual numbers for the backstop, you know, would that be better for us to actually see that versus just an open, you know, up to 50, where we actually have, all right, here's the pricing, mm-hmm. here's the exact backstop, so there's no question that, oh, maybe it went to 55, or in the good news, it's 35, you know, whatever.
Right. And that would be built into the contract. That would, again, because they haven't gone out to get those discrete bids just yet, once those bids are in, then it comes back into the management committee for validation and ultimately.
But so how long will it take if you were to get to that point?
That's about 60 days to get those bids in.
Okay. So you can have it done by the first of the year?
If we had $50 million today, yes.
Well, I'm not saying having 50, you're looking for a backstop, right?
Correct.
All right. So the real question I'm really getting to is that if you, you know, we like the deal in certainty. So certainty is this is how much it costs to do it. Not up to, but this is the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be a contingency in there for you that we talk about. Of course, the contractor would never know what the contingency is, but you'd, mm-hmm. you know, put something in. I mean, is that a possibility here?
It's through negotiation with that pipeline company. I mean, we've, in the past, the state said to us, go out and do this. What we've done now in electing with this pipeline company is to be able to bring in their expertise to be able to drive forward and put in place then those owner conditions that they would then like to see executed and constructed and operate to. So that's why we've gone out to that third party. I understand what you're saying is come back or identify what it is actually going to cost based on the bids and contingency.
To me, you're at a disadvantage if they already know how much you've got for a backstop, right? If they don't know that,
mm-hmm.
you know, obviously ask them for that, but if they don't know that and say, no, I can't, you know, the rule is I have to go in with a number, guys, not a up to. I need the number, and it gives you a better negotiating for what you want, as long as you can identify the scope. if the scope's still, you know, a work in progress, then that's a problem as far as coming for an exact, you know, number. I don't call it a hard number bid, but it is a proposal with a number on it under certain, and with certain conditions, exceptions, inclusion, exclusions, right? That's kind of how it is. That would help us to identify so we know exactly what it is. And I think it would help you when you go in front of the legislature. It's the number. Here's the number. And here's the scope subject to, you know, A, B, C, and D. But I don't know if that's a possibility.
Dana, this is...
That's kind of your bailiwick.
Julie's
piping. Yeah, Julie.
Sorry, I just want to be clear that I think I understand. So are you just asked for an independent, like, cost analysis to be put into the RFP. Yeah. Is that correct?
Say that again, Julie.
You're asking for an independent cost analysis, and I just want to be clear that I heard Frank's response, which is that it can be built into the RFP. I just want to make sure that I'm hearing that correctly.
So what the chairman's suggesting, Commissioner, is that we go forward and get actual bids from the EPC contractors to conduct the FEED. Then we would have a clear delineation of what the costs would be to be able to execute the FEED from the EPC perspective, and then we would need to get then an owner's cost cap amount from the pipeline company to be able to manage that FEED level of effort. Then that would provide then more surety in terms of what the actual cost would be, as opposed to a cap of up to $50
million. Randy?
Okay, thank you.
So is there a number of outtakes that are permitted, or is that excluded from the permit? In other words, where you can take the gas off the line?
No, sir. When we were given this project by ExxonMobil, at that time they were limited to three. We said, from our perspective, we want to make sure that Alaskans have access to the gas. So as entities come forward and say, we want the gas, and we have an economic, commercially viable offtake, then we are going to entertain that and provide that. So
that part is not permitted.
It's really just creating a valve along the pipeline.
From the permitting process.
Correct? Under the FERC permit, we included offtake options.
But no number stated.
No.
Great. So I heard that you have all of the federal permits in place. Are there any state permits that have to be yet put in place?
Yes, sir. There will be state permits, but the long lead permits are those federal permits. So that Federal Energy Regulatory FERC permit for the LNG export, the Department of Energy authorization to export to non-free trade countries, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife incidental take authorizations, all of those. The state permits are going to be the ones along the right-of-way, like a fish stream crossing. So those are Title 16 that really they want to know when you're going to be coming, how you're going to be crossing the stream. So they're more tactical permits that are shorter duration in terms of what it's going to take to actually accomplish them. And they also come with a timeline. So those would be developed and making sure that we're going to have those permits in hand ready to go to execution. So that'll be part of the FEED process.
Thank you.
Further questions, Bill?
No, I'm good.
Anything more, Julie?
No, nothing from me. Thanks very much, Frank. We appreciate the presentation.
Yeah, thanks, Rand.
All right, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Good info. Appreciate you waiting for us today.
You bet.
Okay, director's comments. What's up?
Right. Project updates, Chair, 7A. Ambler is in a similar status as it has been for several months with a suspended, revoked right-of-way permit, actually a finding by the Department of Interior, a no-build finding, which is directly contrary to several statutes in ANILCA. We are preparing to push forward, push back on that decision, which is contrary to federal law. We're also meeting, we continue our outreach chair with the SAC, the Subsistence Advisory Committee. We met during AFN with, I think, five or six communities represented. They want jobs, they want economic development, and they want a future for their kids, and they're supportive of the project. And so that's outreach is going well. They're also continue to refine their protections for subsistence and fish and game, which are going to be stronger than what's in place at the Red Dog Road, but still manageable. ANWR, Chair, as you're aware, our leases were canceled by the Biden administration. We're preparing for a second lease sale in December, late December of 2024. The board passed a resolution today that would allow the executive team to perform due diligence and then go forward and potentially bid on leases in this upcoming sale. The West Sioux Road field season was completed, and we anticipate filing for a core permit and a NEPA process here in the next few months. That will kick off that process for a 404 permit and a NEPA decision to build that project.
You have a timeline, you think? That's just estimated.
Oh, I think for filing, I think we're within probably 30 to 60 days of filing. NEPA processes now have to be done in 2 years or less under federal law, so that if they stick to that, that would be the timeline for those. That's 5 years less than the standard average for a NEPA. It can take, on average, between 5 and 7 years to complete. Congress said that's too long, so we're anticipating that they'll meet their two-year new guidelines. The Red Dog Extension Road is not an ADA project, excuse me, but we're keeping an eye on it because it ties into the use of the ADA, DeLong Mountain Transportation System. That extension road project has been delayed. Its permit was requested in 2018. It's now going on its sixth year. Permit has not been granted. And that's going to create some real timing issues for the mine to be able to continue in operations. They have to permit and build the road, and then they have to permit and build new mining operations on the state land to the northwest. So we're watching that project because of its impact on the use of our road and port. Let's see. I think that's pretty much it for the immediate projects we're keeping an eye on, Chair.
Okay.
Item 7B is a quick IT update. We've got Leonard Robertson here, and Brandon can address that.
Our favorite subject.
We'll be brief.
What?
Very brief.
Well, welcome.
Welcome. Yeah, push the button.
Board, this is Leonard Robertson. Thank you for this chance to just give you a brief update on one of the projects that you guys have done during the last. I need to put on my cheaters so I can actually read my notes real quick.
All right.
Okay, I left my cheaters over here. Let me go. Can't read a piece of paper in front of my head. Yeah, exactly. I'm embracing it well. The project was in regards to the former system Navision, which we're still using with on-premise equipment and going to SysLogic Mission ERP, which is the updated version of that. During that process, the two sister agencies are bifurcating their budget systems into the new ERP platform. So they'll have a better transparency into how they manage their costs and also how they segregate their different business and also the cost in developing that platform. The primary update.
Do you have a copy of this?
Pardon me?
Does Julie have a copy of this?
I believe it was sent out. You have correct. I'll resend it.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Randy, what was the question?
If you have a copy of the memorandum from Leonard.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the primary point of today's update is just to point out the current progress is that we have we completed the vendor selection and we've engaged with the vendor. We've had the initial meeting and kickoff with the stakeholders and internal experts and begun to ensure everything is aligned with the business needs of both agencies. and we're in the middle of assessing how the data will be transferred to the new system and ensure that smooth transition of data. The next steps, which we anticipate to update the board, is we're confirming the system design and configuration does meet the unique needs of both business agencies. And after that, we'll start migrating data in phases and train staff on the new system to ensure minimal disruption. As requested, we'll continue to provide updates to the board, but we expect to go live for fiscal year July 1.
All right. So the question I want to make sure is that we're never going to have to send out a email or a letter saying if your information has been hacked. Change all your passwords.
So
I've seen that before.
You know, considering the roles I've served over the years, I've seen it, and I've gone into several agencies after the fact. It hurts my heart, one, as an Alaskan and also as a state employee. That being said, the project number two is also to assist the agency in moving from what's considered a traditional on-premise to leveraging a distributed cloud presence and also to modernize the workforce. I know we're short on time, but we are actually looking at updating the system. That's part of the reason I was brought on, was to assess where can we improve our security, playing off of my former background and understanding what really works and what doesn't. So that is my first concern, but I also know better than to promise.
So I have a jaded opinion. I think that the software developers, designers, you know, they're hired, they're getting a salary, you know, then they realize, well, if I quit, I know the loopholes. If someone wants a loophole, I can certainly tell them what it is, not that I'm going to do it. And that's a different business model. So, you know, anything that's built up that's by people, they'll know where the weaknesses are. And the key is to figure that out before they leave the company that they did design for.
Insider and supply chain security is one of the things on my radar.
Yeah, okay.
So we anticipate this rollout, if you will, to be for a period of time that we'll receive benefits before we have to go down this road again. Do you have any insight into that duration?
So the initial build-out of this is anticipated to be before July 1. Over time, transparency and turning what has been at times a capital cost type model of upgrading when we realize that a system is too old, is we will turn it more into a transparent rate. And especially between the two sister agencies is that not only with this system, the goal is over the next years to build out and two, make it so that it lifts into a platform as a service model to where we're now actually able to even code what application is being used where. That's part of the project number two is that we're going to lift to appropriate cloud platforms. We've spent a lot of time today talking about AI and cloud providers. We're also looking at leveraging that similar to what other agencies such as ourselves, large or small. So to your question earlier today, transparency in the cost is one of those big reasons to do this and to actually also finish the bifurcation of the two sister agencies.
I anticipate this to be another profit opportunity for the software company down the road, and that's where I was headed with my question.
So the model that all of the software companies that are major seem to be making that we're all wrapping our heads around is just that the software that we were able to take on-premise is no longer going to be supported in the future. They're moving us to their platforms. One, they don't want to hear that we or some other agency with their product name shows up in the news. They want to control their product name also and make sure it stays out of the news. So going to platform as a service is a part of what even we as customers are looking for, is how our data is being handled. That will be up to us to also work with them and make sure they're handling our data appropriately.
Did we get a duration of support from the software company? how long they will be able to support this new software?
We'll be moving into a longer-term support model. Instead of where we would pay for a version, we're moving into with them over time. It becomes a repeatable every year software cost.
Updated automatically.
Yep. And then in the long run, the next stage will for us to actually, we're building it on-premise, but in the long run, we'll be moving to it also as a platform as a service where we will, you know, we have a small IT team, but we'll be able to leverage the expertise of those that are experts in each one of these different platforms that we use, especially the ERP, to make sure that that is maintained by the best of the best. And then we become the data owners and the data custodians, but we're using them as a service and their security centers as a service.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
You.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good luck. We can read the last, the C, D, and E. You know, we can look at that. So that's in our board pack. That's nothing different. So my schedule is a little bit different. So when is our next board meeting?
We decided November 7th.
November 7th. So please put that on everybody's calendar. Would you put a meeting invite out? Okay. Anything else you want to add, Randy?
No, Mr. Chair, we'll come back for the next meeting with some additional information,
okay.
You know, on the items you requested, the okay. Board's requested.
All right. Brings me to board comments. Any comments from anybody?
Good meeting. As always, like to appreciate staff and hard work that everybody puts in. Keep us informed.
I'm really good.
Julie?
No, I don't think I have anything. I echo that. I appreciate everything that the staff has done to pull all this together. It was a lot today, but I appreciate it.
And our hurricane survivor?
nothing to add. Lots of great information today. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. When do you come back, Bill?
Or do I will be back. Oh yeah, I'm coming. Spring. No.
Yeah.
I'll be back on the second. I'll be at that meeting on the 7th.
All right. Great. Well, thanks Randy, to you and your crew and your team and the information, good information. Appreciate it. Thank you to the board working today.